AM 950, Matt McNeil. Hello there, members. We do appreciate you very much. Thank you very much for sponsoring AM 950. We truly do appreciate it. If you'd like to become a member or just renew your membership, if you know someone that wants to become a member, go to am950radio.there. And if you've done the one-time donation, you can always make another donation. We do appreciate that. Thanks for helping to keep Progressive Radio on the air in Minneapolis-St. Paul through the election cycle. We do appreciate it. So not only is a part of the content that we do here for members also brand new interviews, and we got some great ones coming up here over the next few weeks, but we also like to revisit some of the interviews that we had. And I felt it was important this week after what the city has gone through to understand that this the narrative of white supremacists, of racists, that the death of George Floyd is just, you know, there it was tragic, but probably not as much of a crime as they want to believe it is, or if they want to insist that it's something of the fact that just, you know, the African American community is overreacting. We in the holidays, this last holiday season, talked to Christopher Lehman, Professor Christopher Lehman, Slavery's Reach, Southern Slave Owners in the North Star State. And the book, and we're going to replay that interview for you here. And one of the things that really kind of is a jolt to the system, to say the least, is the amount of Southern slave owners who had bought land in Minnesota were the big wealthy people within any community, and how those communities in many places of Minnesota were pro-slavery and felt as if the state should not be an anti-slavery state, that the state should allow slavery, especially come summer times when these Southern plantation owners would come up into the northern parts of the country, and they'd come to Minnesota and they'd stay at their resorts or in their cabins or wherever they were at, and they wanted to bring their slaves, not for a vacation, but as slaves, that they wanted the slaves to basically be their slaves here as well as they were in the Confederate South. The reality is that was horrible. And I know that there's a lot of communities that might be embarrassed by that fact. But you see, you can't learn from history by ignoring it. And I mean, my God, I mean, that is what is playing out here right now in Minneapolis. How many times has a Minneapolis police officer killed an African-American man, usually under suspicious circumstances, sometimes under circumstances that don't make any damn sense whatsoever, followed by Republican politicians talking about, I stand with the cops, bad guy deserved it, followed by the police department, and namely the police union, doing a character assassination on the victim, talking about how they're a gangbanger, a drug dealer, or one of those things. Followed by an incompetent prosecutorial department who either A, doesn't press charges because, well, what am I supposed to do? You know, I don't think I could get a conviction. Or when they do, doing a half-ass attempt at prosecution to where you get to a point where the person has no chance of getting convicted. Then to have the police department basically taunt the family, taunt the African-American community, taunt the minority community of this city, taunt all the citizens of the city, saying, what you going to do about it? As they show their police officers how to stash their money away to prevent civil trials from getting any of their money. The reason why this city exploded, and trust me, I went down there yesterday. I went into South Minneapolis. I was on Lake Street. I went down to the George Floyd Memorial over on 38th in Chicago. I went over to what could only be described as the war zone over on 55 and Lake Street. I mean, my God, the buildings there looked like bombed out buildings from the Civil War. That's the first thing I said is like, this looks like these. I've seen images from the Civil War that look like this. To into St. Paul in the Midway area where damaged buildings and, you know, looting had happened over there. The reality is that This is a case of what happens when you do not hold people accountable for crimes we all see. And for us to then go back in time and try to candy coat or dismiss or ignore the fact that even in Minnesota, where we like to consider ourselves progressives and we like to consider ourselves, you know, free thinking and liberals and all that stuff, the reality is this state has a long history of racism, a long history of racism. Going back to the very beginning of this state, when areas of this state were saying that slaves should be allowed in Minnesota. I'm a white guy. I can't speak authoritatively in any capacity about the life experiences of the minority community, but I'm smart enough to where I can read and say, holy crap, that's godly, ungodly unfair. That's just unbelievable, that the lives and the way they've lived. I mean, how many people over the last week have pointed out the protests happening near interstates where the communities specifically went into African-American communities, many of the middle-class communities, and wiped them out just so they could build the interstate system. I just had a notice coming up the beginning of the Tulsa race riots from the 1920s, where they went into the affluent African-American area of Tulsa and basically shot them and killed them all. And you know, said, how dare you as black people be successful? And that tragedy hasn't gotten nearly the coverage. Whether it's the 1980s or 1990s in Los Angeles or in New York, or if it's 2020 in Minneapolis. The reality is you watch what happened to George Floyd. You watch that. That wasn't an accident. That was intentional. And that was a police department who says, what you gonna do? And have you noticed it took 1 week for a single Minneapolis police officer to finally come on out and say, yeah, that was too aggressive. 1 week, only one police officer from the Minneapolis force, the chief, has condemned what those four non-police officers did. They all got fired. If you don't understand the history, then you will never be able to understand why we get to the point that we're at. The ignorant are the reason why we have to constantly repeat ourselves historically. So I'm going to take you back in time. This is not only taking you back in time to December of last year, but I'm going to take you back in time to the turning of this country, the beginnings of statehood for Minnesota, and the beginnings of the Civil War, slavery's reach, Southern slave owners in the North Star State. Professor Christopher Layman, here is that interview right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Professor Christopher Layman is kind enough to join us right now. Slavery's Reach, Southern Slave Owners in the North Star State is the book that is, it talks about the Minnesota's history with slavery, and it's actually far more reaching than people, I think, want to admit. Professor Layman, thank you very much. I appreciate the time today.
Thanks for inviting me.
My absolute privilege. I want to start with something that you kind of touch on, is that really from the beginning of white Europeans coming to the state, there has always been, to a point, a bit of a slavery presence. Is that a fair way to say it?
Yes, I think that's fair to say, because when Southerners would come to Minnesota to invest in real estate, they would take probably one or two slaves with them. And at the time, people who were supportive of slavery, even if they didn't necessarily want to have slaves themselves, for running Minnesota's government, even when Minnesota was a territory, back then it wasn't up to the people to elect a governor or lieutenant governor. They were chosen by the White House. And typically a president chooses people who have the same kind of politics as he does. And in 1853, in 1857, the presidents who came into the White House were Democrats. And the Democratic Party back then was in favor of slavery where it was and wanted it to extend into the territories. So they had one case between 1853 and 57 where the president appointed a slaveholder from Virginia to be our lieutenant governor, or what was called a territorial secretary. And he served all 4 years for the president's term as well. I think the president was Franklin Pierce. And it's just this weird situation where someone who was one heartbeat away from the governor's office in Minnesota was a slaveholder. And the book also touches on the fur trade and how the American Fur Company, which had trading posts all over Minnesota, was actually owned by a company whose partners were slaveholders from St. Louis. So anyone in Minnesota who worked for American Fur was actually getting paid by those slaveholders. And one of them was Henry Sibley, who was the first governor of Minnesota when it became a free state. And Sibley was still working for that company while he was the governor. So that's why slavery was able to happen as much as it was, with Southerners bringing their one or two slaves during their visits and not having to free them, because nobody in power had their hands totally free of slavery.
Well, and we should mention a few things here. The Northwest Territory at that point was supposed to be a slave-free area.
That's right. We had the Northwest Ordinance in 1787 and the Missouri Compromise in 1820. So there were two federal laws already on the books by the time Minnesota Territory was organized in 1849. But from the very beginning, the federal government disobeyed its own law for the interest of having the area protected and to have business interests expanded. When Fort Snelling was constructed in the 1820s, the federal government allowed military officers from the South to be deployed at Fort Snelling with their slaves, because the government needed to have some kind of incentive for people from the very warm South to come up to a very cold Minnesota. So, even though there were those two laws, the government said, it doesn't matter, you can bring your slaves, we'll even give you a stipend to help care for the costs of them.
You know, and it's interesting as you bring this up, because the Fort Snelling has brought up the Dred Scott history. But this year, they really did embrace the fact that, okay, there was a lot of slaves here at Fort Snelling, including the eventual President Zachary Taylor, who was stationed there, had his own slaves as well. It was a very ugly part of American history. How much do you think that that tolerance of the military leaders at Fort Snelling having slavery led to the ambivalence towards other people bringing in slaves? Because clearly, I mean, the idea that there was this definitive line between the North and the South, that really didn't exist. You brought up already finances. Your book breaks down finances, insurance as well, talking about how those things crossed borders. But as well, this mentality of, well, as long as no one's going to enforce it, yeah, the slaves are okay in Minnesota. How much do you think that was established by the fort itself?
Well, I think what the fort did was set a precedent that as long as people are here temporarily with their slaves, then it's okay. And I think it was easy for Minnesotans to say, well, these military officers are not really Minnesotans. They're people from other parts of the country, and they're just these outliers. Once their time at the fort is done, they'll go back to the South with their slaves, and then that'll be that. And I think that same mentality carried over when it came to the people who were staying at the hotels, that they would just be there for the spring and summer months. They would go back with their slaves in the fall. And especially before statehood, Minnesotans were thinking, we want to be a free state. We don't want to have slavery here. And even Southerners weren't interested in bringing a big slave plantation kind of economy to Minnesota. All that the Southerners wanted to do was to have some sort of political investment, as long as along with a financial investment. They figured that as long as they could own parts of Minnesota, then whenever they wanted to make sure that Minnesota would not be too hard of an anti-slavery state, then there were people in Minnesota who were taking the money from the Southerners who would go along with that. And while it has been for most of Minnesota's history that slavery was illegal, it had never been illegal for Minnesotans to conduct business with slaveholders as long as they weren't buying and selling people. So that's why you could still have that paper trail from slave capital in the South to Minnesotans in the North, because the money was going towards land mm-hmm. in Minnesota.
And they would come up north. I mean, you mentioned that there was at one point a few hundred Minnesotans who actually were petitioning the state to legally turn a blind eye to slave owners, that if they were coming up, because it was common, there were a lot of these resorts, people would come up here and, you know, spend the summer months in Minnesota, and it was a common thing that if a slave owner brought their slaves, that would be okay, that would not be outlawed, and that would be tolerated. How much was that a more popular sentiment, or was that a fringe idealism when it was initially proposed here in Minnesota?
Well, the sentiment was certainly popular among the people who made a lot of money from the sales of real estate, especially when you look at the history of Minnesota, starting from its territorial organization. It begins as a free territory in March of 1849, and it remains that way for 8 years. And then all of a sudden, in March of 1857, the Dred Scott decision makes slavery legal in all the territories. And yeah. Minnesota was still a territory at that time. So for the next 14 months until statehood, slavery was legal in Minnesota. So that meant that during the spring and the summer of 1857, during that tourism season, there was this influx of slaveholders who came to Minnesota because they knew for certain that there wasn't going to be any kind of legal hassle about the slaves. But then the following year, when Minnesota is a free state, there's this conundrum of making sure that Minnesotans can still attract Southerners for the tourism season. And by and large, they're still able to because, again, Henry Sibley is the governor, and he still works for slaveholders based in St. Louis. John Prince, who is the mayor of St. Paul, was another one of those employees of those slaveholders. So as mayor, he wasn't going to enforce any anti-slavery laws either. Prince, by the way, was the founder of Princeton, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. But what happens in 1859 is that the state of Minnesota elects a Republican governor. And back then, the Republican Party was the party that tolerated slavery where it was, but just did not want it to expand to the territories. There's only the most radical of Republicans, who are a very small minority, who didn't want slavery at all. But the fact that there had been that minority in the party led a lot of Minnesotans to be worried that with the Republican in office as Minnesota's governor, Southerners wouldn't want to come to Minnesota for the tourism season of 1860. So there were some lawmakers in the Minnesota legislature who were invested in having those tourism dollars, who drafted these proposals to have Minnesota legalize slavery only in the tourism months. Fortunately, those bills failed in both the Minnesota House and the Minnesota Senate, but they did not fail unanimously. And among the lawmakers who voted for those proposals were people who had really made a killing with money from sales of land to slaveholders. Charles McCubbin of St. Paul was one of them because he was originally from Maryland, and he knew slaveholding relatives and friends in Maryland. And the other that I can think of off the top of my head was George Sweet, who had made a lot of money in sales, like thousands of dollars in sales in Sauk Rapids, where he was.
One of the things your book touches on here, and it's something that it's, you know, there's a long history here in St. Cloud itself. It seems as if there was a pinpoint of a pro-slavery element. St. Cloud area really did seem to be that place from its initial foundings. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, it is, because Sylvanus Lowry, who also worked for that American Fur Company, bought the northern third of the original St. Cloud in 1855. St. Cloud became incorporated as a city the following year, and Lowry was chosen as the town council president, or essentially the office of mayor. And during his time as mayor, he recruited buyers from where his father lived in Tennessee. And Lowry made $12,000 in sales just from the Tennessee slaveholders alone in the spring and summer of 1856. And not too long afterward, Lowry used that money to start businesses in the northern third of St. Cloud. And since there was really no other substantial business community in the city, we can safely say that the slavery capital that Lowry received from Tennessee allowed him to create St. Cloud's business community.
And with it, I mean, because I think it's interesting that this the legacy of this still exists today. I mean, there have been some incidents in St. Cloud over the years. I remember I read a phenomenal article in Minnesota History Magazine in regards to basically the persecution of African Americans in the community well after the Civil War as well. It really did set a temperament that, and it does kind of show that. We have this idea that once the Civil War started, of course, Minnesota was the first to offer up troops and, you know, the Republicans and the rise of the Republican Party. The reality was that I think it's kind of similar to as we've had discussions about World War One and World War Two, is there were pockets there. It definitely seems like there were pockets of this state who were more on the side of the Confederates than they were on the side of the Union.
Well, the thing to understand about Minnesota and the Civil War is that although Minnesota was among the first to join the Union side, they were not joining the Union side to end slavery. They were joining the Union side to essentially try to teach the Confederates a lesson about leaving the Union. And hopefully the war would be short, the Confederate states would come back, and then that would be the end of it. So even by the time you have Abraham Lincoln issue the Emancipation Proclamation in January of 1863, there are still states that are with the Union that are border states and that are slave states. So even at that point, the proclamation was only saying that the Confederate states had to free their slaves, not all the states. So for anyone to say that Minnesota joined the Civil War from the start to end slavery is just completely inaccurate. And what I found in my book was that even after the Civil War started, there were still people who lived in Confederate states who owned a lot of land in Minnesota, and some of those residents of Confederate states even joined the Confederate Army. So there is this situation where people who would be considered enemies of the country owned land in the country that they were fighting against. Now, there are some cases where some of those people in Minnesota acted as powers of attorney for the Confederate residents. So if a Confederate resident wanted to have his land in Minnesota sold, then he asked his power of attorney in Minnesota to handle the sales. But that happened, and I think probably the most powerful Confederate to own land in Minnesota was the Confederate governor of Tennessee, Robert Carruthers. He owned probably a fourth of the land that Sylvanus Lowry had owned in St. Cloud. I think Carruthers bought a fourth of it in 1856 or so. And he still owned it when the Civil War began. Now, Carruthers was elected governor, but because the Union had controlled a lot of Tennessee by the time Carruthers won, he never actually got to serve in office as a Confederate governor. But he still has that tie with the Confederacy to St. Cloud through land ownership.
You know, I think one of the things your book does very well is explain that it's okay. Yeah, you might not have had, you know, there were people that definitely brought slaves up here, and hence we did have slavery here. But there was a lot of people in Minnesota that might not have had slaves, but the financial ties basically hampered any real anti-slavery movements here because just they needed that Southern money in the state as far as investment.
That's right. Not only were there entire neighborhoods like the Northern Third of St. Cloud or the Payne-Phelan neighborhood of St. Paul, but there were entire towns, like the town of Belle Plaine and the town of Shakopee, which would not have existed if there weren't Southern slaveholders who invested as much money as they did. Now, in the cases of Belle Plaine and Shakopee, those towns were funded almost completely by people who had owned plantations in the South, and they decided to move to Minnesota permanently, so they sold all their slaves so that they would have the money to buy as much of Belle Plaine and as much of Shakopee as they did. And both the newspaper advertisements for those sales are quoted in the book.
The, you know, were there, because obviously after the Civil War, there wasn't a lot for the Southern slave owners back then. Did a lot of them move to Minnesota where their land was after that?
I haven't found evidence that they moved to Minnesota. What I did find was that they sold their land maybe within 1 or 2 years of the war ending, perhaps so that they would have money in the South to use to reconstruct their own lives in southern states. And there was one occasion where that happened even before the war officially ended. With that person, Robert Carruthers, some of the land that he had bought was actually not with his money, but with money from the university where he worked, which was Cumberland University in Tennessee. Cumberland had assigned Carruthers to buy land in the name of the Cumberland trustees, but Carruthers bought it in his own name instead. So in 1864, the Union troops conquer the town of Lebanon, Tennessee, where the university was, and they completely torch the university itself. So the Cumberland trustees are trying to figure out how to rebuild, and then they realize that Robert Carruthers has this land of theirs in his name. So the trustees actually sued Carruthers in a Minnesota court, and the court found in favor of the trustees. So the Cumberland trustees owned that land, and they appointed someone in St. Cloud, power of attorney, to eventually sell the land.
It was a common problem for the Southerners. Their currency was worthless, and on top of that, they owed a bunch of back taxes, so they didn't have any money at all. It doesn't surprise me. This is your book, Professor Christopher Layman, Slavery's Reach: Southern Slave Owners in the North Star State. This is a must read. This is because I think you do not learn from history unless you look at both sides of the coin, and this is one of those things that unless we come to grips with Minnesota's full role here, whether that's at Fort Snelling in St. Cloud, these other communities, or with the founders of the state, the reality is we can't learn from it and make ourselves better. It is a great book, Slavery's Reach. You know, Christopher, I really appreciate the time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. You're more than welcome to come on back. I do hope you do. If you write more books, I'd love to have you come on back. We're going to take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. You see us together. Chase.